Guilt was the very first thing that really made me start asking questions. That big, heavy emotion. It sits on your chest. It begs for my attention when I try to block it out. And as diaspora, I'm not alone in that. I'm Larissa Sebrick, and welcome back to Generation Removed. This is episode 2, The Burden of Guilt. For me, it isn't just guilt that spurs my curiosity the most, it's guilt that's hinged on regret. Regret that I feel removed from my heritage, that it disappeared from a young age and somewhat out of my control. And it's also guilt that I don't feel more inspired to do anything about it, even in the face of war. I didn't really come across heritage existential guilt in my research, but it was one of the first things I asked the psych prof Ben Chung about because I felt it so strongly. And it's one of the biggest things he comes across.
There's a lot of different sources of that guilt. Or rather, people can feel that diasporic guilt for a lot of different reasons.
He wasn't joking. Almost every person I spoke with had a different version of guilt that they carried. Elliot and I, we felt guilty for not caring enough. Megan felt guilty for caring too much. Bashar felt guilty for not being able to help. Amani didn't feel guilty at all. And neither did Bahare. But Ben, he felt guilty for being able to get up and turn off the news. Day after day, he would watch the protests in Hong Kong and then just turn it off and go teach his class. But those in Hong Kong who were living in the heart of the protests, they could never leave it.
And I remember during November, during the height of the protests, I was essentially more or less just a walking husk on campus as I walked from classroom to teach, and then back to my office and then back home where I started watching it again. And, you know, talking with other colleagues, they would talk about how, you know, sometimes you just have to just turn it off. And I totally understand that. And I think that would have been better for mental health. But that also comes with that feeling of guilt, of thinking, I can do that. And I look out the window and everything is fine. It's all green. There's no tear gas canisters billowing in the wind. And there's no fires that are burning. But then I feel immensely guilty for having that privilege of being able to turn it off and pretend that nothing is happening. So I think that...
Again, Ben studies diaspora, but he also is diaspora. He's someone who has experienced firsthand everything I'm asking about, but he also thinks about it in an objective kind of way.
They can also feel guilty because if they ever get overwhelmed by the news that they're hearing, by the stories that they're learning about, and by the images that they're seeing, they can always turn everything off. And that's a luxury that they recognize that people, again, quote unquote, back home, don't have. And this is something that I've recognized when during the Hong Kong protests, when I was basically just immersed in, it was at that time what was dubbed as the most live-streamed protests in the history of the world. And so every day you can see from multiple camera angles what was happening at different scenes in Hong Kong. And I was so immersed in it that it was very, very bad for my mental health.
Guilt. It can take its toll in a really negative way. There's vicarious trauma, helplessness. It can overwhelm you to the point of feeling like you're drowning. But guilt can also be a motivator, and action is often a ripple effect. Sometimes a heavy negative emotion like guilt can spur that action forward. Before I get into guilt as a motivator, I had an interview that talked about an entirely different kind of drive towards action. That drive was a sense of duty, of it being the least she could do. Bahare Shigematsu is a first-generation Iranian woman living in Vancouver. Her childhood memories of Iran are also memories of fleeing. But when I asked if Iran still feels like home, she said yes. Here's where I need to be honest. Bahare and I spoke for nearly an hour, and I lost the tape. But it was such a powerful conversation. And what she had to say was really important to me and to the podcast in general. Bahari is someone who also can't turn off the news, like Ben. She cries, she feels pain, and then she acts. She shared that she posts videos and news from Iran, citizen journalism that portrays what she says is actually happening there. She gathers with other diaspora members every Saturday. She takes her kids. Looking at her Facebook feed or her Instagram, you'll see a barrage of photos, selfies, comments, and just images of support. What Bahari doesn't feel is guilt. Like Ben, she won't turn off the TV or the news. But unlike Ben, she lived in Iran during conflict. She survived. She wants to go back. So for all the people still there who are risking their lives to make her homeland a better place, she sees it as her duty to get involved as diaspora. Sometimes she feels like it isn't enough, but she will not let herself feel guilty for it. For some people I spoke to, though, they don't have a choice but to feel guilty.
Of guilt as well. And then there's also a source of guilt where people will try to provide aid, but feeling like it's just not enough, or feeling like it might be disingenuous. You know, the best that they could do was maybe they'll donate some money, right? Or all that they could do, their studies looking at this, and they were talking about how all that they could do was to just post a supportive message online. And they also feel guilty because they're just thinking, what's that gonna do? Like, that's all I can do, but what is that going to do? And then that also makes them feel immensely guilty as well. And I think this is kind of why you have diasporic groups that often band together to, you know, individually it's hard to think of what you can do, but you can sort of try to get together to create a larger, a much bigger impact.
So it's almost like for the diaspora, there's two sides. There's kind of the shadow of the war, which is a negative side of kind of social media and having war just a click away. But there's also the benefit that you can be removed from it and still kind of find action to help alleviate.
Yeah. And I think the being able to turn away becomes a huge source of guilt. And I think the community action that happens oftentimes is the result of that kind of guilt.
Talking to Ben always makes me feel a little bit better, but I'm curious why I didn't see guilt in my research, and admittedly, maybe I just didn't know to look for it. But I wonder how much my feeling of guilt has to do with news and social media, that constant stream of imagery of what's happening to a place you have ties to, real or imaginary. It's this posturing and outpouring from others on their pages, the solidarity posts, the blue and the yellow every time I turn on my phone. What did come up in my research on identity and social media is that sometimes we use it to portray parts of us we wish were true. That validation and social feedback loop that verifies who we think we are or who we want to be. And sometimes, by presenting ourselves as who we want to be, we become it. I wonder how many people I see on social media who are suddenly posting about being Ukrainian, suddenly want to have it as part of their identity. I wonder if social media heightened the guilt that I feel, that need to present myself as Ukrainian to be verified by my peers. I wonder, if I didn't have social media, would I even be asking these questions? What to post, what not to post? I'm so aware of what I think other people expect to see. As Ben said, maybe it's just better for your mental health to just turn everything off. But at the same time, social media also lets me finally build an image of my homeland, of community, images that are more tangible than stories of memories gone by from older generations. It's the now.
So that's something that I thought about too, is like, what is it about conflict that makes us like, is it like it spurs just a curiosity of, oh shit, there's a whole part of myself that it's almost too late, or like I'm gonna lose it if I don't look at it now because of a conflict? Or is it like, I need to care more about this, so I should know more because this is now at the forefront and people are gonna ask me about it? Because you said you've been interested in it, and then when the conflict started, you kind of started looking more at that culture.
Yeah.
So what do you... We're back with my friend Elliot. He's not big on social media in terms of posting, but he's one of those silent watchers, the scrollers on standby who say nothing, but they see everything.
Yeah.
So what do you think that is for people?
I think for me, it was just like pure exposure. Like honestly, like before this whole conflict, like when I like my exposure to Ukrainian, like I said, my grandpa never talked about it. It was the food and everything. But like, you know, since this kind of has all happened, it's even like really tragic to see, like on the news in the morning and stuff, you see like the images of people, you see the videos of people, you hear about all these people who are like super proud to be Ukrainian. You see all like the local churches around me, all the like Ukrainian churches doing their like pierogi sales and their drives, the cabbage rolls. You see everyone getting involved with the culture. And just my like sheer like media exposure, it's like I'm learning a lot about the people of Ukraine, just not even like purposely going to look for the information, like it's finding me. And I guess that makes you see like this is like these are like, I am directly descended from these people. And it's like I guess just like the increased exposure that's been like on all like social media, on TV media. It's just like I've seen more glimpses of the culture. I've seen the cities, right? Like I've never like I knew Kiev and all those days, but like you're seeing them now, you're seeing them everywhere. And it's just like, this is me. This is like a big part of who I am, but I don't know it, you know?
You feel connected to it anyways, and then it just happens to be in the context of war that you're seeing so much of it.
Yeah, I think I'm putting together like images with an idea, right? Because like I had the idea I'm Ukrainian, it's part of my heritage, but like what does that mean for me? It's like I've never known, but now I can like start seeing images, I can see videos.
As people of the second, third, or fourth generation, we sometimes think we have an idea of homeland or ties to a far-off place, but those ideas are pretty vague. They're built on stories from our grandparents, old photographs, and faded albums. With news and social media, suddenly you have this tangible idea. You've watched videos, you see current images, you can hear people speak. For me, the concept of today's Ukraine, not a mythical homeland from the past, feels like a wall. It's another place that I don't belong. But for Elliot, it's almost an invitation that says, hey, here's what you've been missing. This is us. This is you. His non-judgment leaves an opening for me to ask the same question he did. What does that mean for me? And as we build these new images of home, how does this imagined home, those heritage ties, start to take shape? In episode 3, we'll look at a theme with cultural identity and diaspora called the myth of return. We'll also hear from two new voices who can't achieve that aching return, but both for very different reasons. You've been listening to episode 2 of Generation Removed. I'm Larissa Sebrick.